Welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella, and joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-hosts, Tom Caldwell and Chris Haig. Chris, how are you doing? No answer. Tom, are you there? Oh no, he's not here either. Oh no, guys. Well, we had a very tough time trying to get everybody booked today, and this was the craziest month ever. And Tom was supposed to be here, but he had a situation come up that he had to address. But we do have a guest star. It's not just going to be me alone, which is good. Good for the listeners. Not just going to be me. But we are talking today about the movie To Catch a Thief. But joining me is special guest Philip Mataz. How are you doing, Philip?
I'm good. I'm good, Brandon. How are you?
I'm awesome. Thank you so much for joining.
I think those other
two
guys, I was tracking them down, and I chased their car for about 5 miles, but then it turned out it was their housemaid.
Oh, it was the housemaid. And then,
so they're...
Well, at least it wasn't the chicken that they missed.
Yeah.
So, awesome. Excellent. Well, Philip, you reached out to us because you have a Hitchcock, you know, themed, inspired novel that's going to be coming out.
That's true. So
we want to talk a little bit about that. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you and who you are and your love of Hitchcock, and then tell us a bit about your book that's coming out.
Okay. Yeah, great. I'm a writer. I live in Los Angeles. Done podcasts, produced a couple podcasts, and have been writing books, rather. Mm-hmm. Writing scripts and stuff like that for a long while, too long, but writing books for the last couple of years. I want to try my hand at a mystery. It is technically a cozy mystery, which I feel I took. There's several rules around that. I don't know if you know the rules of cozy mysteries. Nothing's like written in stone, but you can often recognize them because they usually have punny titles. Like, usually they're around a certain amateur sleuth, punny titles, there's one that's like takes place in the crocheting world that's like a skein to die for because of a crochet thread skein. It's like that. There's usually pets involved, sort of like Murder, She Wrote, Agatha Christie level stuff where there's never too much sex. There's never too much violence. Mm-hmm. And frankly, being a Hitchcock fan that I am, I took that to mean it was like, oh, so sort of like Rear Window, you know, where it's like, oh, you can like hint at some stuff and you're like a lot of Hitchcock stuff. It's like, you can kind of imply stuff, but you're really like, it's more wordplay and you're the core mystery is what it's about.
Okay.
Mine is about my amateur sleuth, because it's got to be an amateur sleuth, is a hairstylist who also has psychic abilities.
Okay.
So normally she uses them when she touches a customer's head. She can see into their thoughts and sees what perfect hairstyle they want. So it makes her in great demand. But then one day when she's cutting the hair of a customer she doesn't know, she looks in his head and sees a murdered body.
Okay.
Dun, dun, dun.
Interesting.
And so, yeah. And then she feels compelled to solve it. And it's called The Murderous Haircut of the Mayor of Bel Air. I have no puns. I just have a ridiculous sounding title. But, yeah.
Excellent. Right on. So, you know, writing a book. So you come up with an idea. Generally, about how long does it take you to write a book like this?
Good question. I actually really got the author writing book bug when I first participated in something called National Novel Writing Month, NaNoWriMo, which the challenge there is you write 50,000 words in 30 days, the whole span of November. And it's a fun exercise, and I took it to really help me get my first draft out. So if you're asking how long does it take you to knock out a warts and all first draft, I can apparently do it in 30 minutes or less. No, I can do it in like 30 days. This one though, I did more plotting ahead of time and you know, then it's gone through copious different drafts and that sort of stuff. So I started this one. This is the first one in a series. I started this one back in 2017. So I'm just now releasing it, but I also wanted to wait until I had some others sort of in the pipe. So I have four other stories that are also getting fermented into like a readable a readable format. So my answer to that is anywhere between 1 month or 3 years.
Okay. Yep, yep.
Yeah.
Excellent. Right on. So 50,000, how many 50,000 words generally? So that's like the length of a novel. How many pages is that?
You know, that also varies. And there's lots of ins and outs, it seems, with the sort of business end of book publishing where you want it to be something like that. It seems like more like your trade paperbacks, your trade books need to be closer to 80,000. Mm-hmm. But I have found no problem. I mean, outside of actually coming up with 30,000 good words, I've had no problem finding those gaps in those first drafts. Because sometimes it's, you know, in that fit of just getting out a story, you're kind of just like, they fight. She wins. You know, like there's a lot of like just forward momentum just to get it out there. And then you can go back and go like, oh, okay, well, here's some space for character and here's some space for, you know, whatever it needs for those particular moments. But usually like 80,000 seems like not a rule, but that's what I've been aiming for. Mm-hmm. That's like 320 pages.
Okay. Sounds good.
Yeah.
Now, tell us a little bit about the podcast you've worked on.
The podcast I've worked on, thank you. I have two. One is sort of still kicking. It's called Superpunk Radio. A friend of mine and I, we wrote a bunch of sketch comedy. And Superpunk Radio is like a fake radio station. The first three-ish seasons, we promise all music and no commercials. And then it's just wall-to-wall fake commercials. Mm-hmm. And then recently, we've transitioned into parodies of AM radio. We did one that was sort of like, if Fox News became enamored with the movie The Boss Baby. It's impossible to explain other than that. It makes no sense. And we don't, honestly, between you and me, I'm not sure why some people like it, but some people are like, more of that. We're like, more of that? But okay. So that's one. That's more of a comedy thing. And then another one that I did, similar to your show, is a friend of mine and I went through every single Ramones song alphabetically.
Nice.
So 170-some tracks, skipping all over their career, and then we got to talk to CJ Ramone, got to talk to some producers, some roadies and stuff like that. But that one is called Ramones of the Day, and it is still around.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Ramones, sealed in ember and nothing new coming, but it's still out there.
It's still out there.
Yeah.
So when you did those, would you like play samples from the songs?
We actually didn't. It's funny you mentioned that. I know some shows do. But the Ramones estates are notoriously litigious.
Mm-hmm.
And I honestly, we decided we didn't want to even get close to it. Like they were like, that's not our thing. We based it on another show that did the similar thing with the Beatles. They also did not play clips. And we kind of figured if you're here listening to a show where we're talking about like every single Deep album track by this band, you probably have already heard the song. So we're like, let's just get to the conversation. But I know a lot of shows do that. We just chose to avoid that fight completely.
Okay. Because I've always had a dream of doing that with Patti Smith.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So, but I'm like, legal issues with music and whatnot. But I love Patti Smith. I think she's quite the lyricist and whatnot. And so that's
there'd be a lot to dig in with her too. That's the thing that we found in picking that topic, and like, you know, in picking your show, is not only do you have a lot of catalog, but there's lots of books written on it, or even just without the books, just the text of the pieces are interesting. And then you probably find. Probably found it out already yourself with Patti Smith and with Hitchcock and stuff, is just looking at stuff all laid out, you see themes in there that maybe they didn't know or that nobody ever talked about. And yeah, it was more of like a, we always joked it was more like a special college class that we were both teaching and learning from, you know? So it was like, we're like, oh, I didn't really notice this, but this suddenly makes a lot more sense to me rather than just taking to some 2-minute song that, you know, was about a warthog or whatever.
Mm-hmm. So tell us a little bit about your Hitchcock love. So when did you discover him? Do you have a favorite film?
I do. I'll save that for that big reveal. I think I was prepared for this a little bit. I think I first was introduced to Hitchcock a little bit through The Simpsons.
Okay.
That was the first little bit. But then around college, I was taking a film class. And it was genre and auteur, and the auteur was Alfred Hitchcock. And I'll always remember my mom saying, I think you're going to like that.
Mm-hmm.
Just something about it. I'm like, I think you're going to like that. And she was right. We covered about 12 or maybe 13 or 14 films. And some of them jumped right out at me as I love this. Others took a little longer to ferment, but... Mm-hmm. But then as I paid more attention to his career and even just movies in general and seeing, it was like, oh, it's not like always just the flashy stuff that makes you, say, a great director. It's your ability to land the not flashy stuff when you have to. This is a weird tangent, but it reminds me that there's some story of a comic book artist that he's talking to his publisher and they tell him, and it's like, you should be like that guy. He draws the greatest tables. And it's like, yeah, you can draw Spider-Man doing amazing things, but it kind of all falls apart if you can't do the basics too. Mm-hmm. And so then that really got into me about he takes care of story so much. That's so much their priority that, you know, that famous thing of once we get in there, he's almost bored filming it. Cause he's like, I've already figured it out. And so I was like, oh, okay. He really works on the ABCs right at the top. You got to get that tight first. And I took that to heart myself. That was the thing I most appreciate. Mm-hmm. Favorites. It flips around quite a bit depending on what I'm watching. Anywhere between, it flips around, but it's also a pretty rote answer. I want to give some love to 39 Steps because mm-hmm. I find that is sort of underappreciated generally, but it's just awesome. But Rear Window's way up there. My wife and I probably watch that once a year at least. We successfully got my son into it during the pandemic. We had a outdoor, I got a little projector, a little cheap projector, and put up a sheet and we're like, we're gonna show you this and we think you'll like it. And sure enough, absolutely. When Raymond Burr looks at the camera after seeing The Wedding Ring, he was like, oh. He's 11 years old, but it was like, oh, it works for everybody. This is just so effective. That one and Psycho probably fight for the top. But honestly, the one I've thought the most about is Vertigo. That's the one that at first I laughed at.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just kept challenging myself with it. And now I keep coming back to it. I'm like, oh, there's way more stuff going on in this movie than I gave it credit for. But those are my picks.
Nice. I can't wait to get to Vertigo again because it's been a while since I've seen it, and I know it's a really great film. So, but a lot of Hitchcock films, I've only seen once or twice at most. And today's one that we're going to talk about. I'm pretty sure this is the second time I've seen it, and so it's pretty fresh. And there was a lot of twists and turns in it that I couldn't remember.
No.
So that's pretty cool.
No, I'm awesome. I'm really looking forward to your Vertigo. I've been listening to the show too, and I'm looking forward to. When I first discovered your show, I was like, have they gotten to Vertigo yet? Because I want to know. Because it's almost like being canonized so much now, the greatest film ever. And it has rose up the charts. But I still think there's room for, if not criticism, just debate around those things of values. Even. It's so warped around and it's kind of warpy anyway that, I'll be really curious to hear.
Awesome. I hope we don't disappoint. I'm looking forward to that.
No, I don't think it could.
Excellent. Well, here on the Hitchcock podcast, with the director not making films anymore because he passed many, many years ago, we don't have a lot of news to discuss on Hitchcock, but we do have one that sad news that happened this week. So Norman Lloyd, who was an actor in Saboteur way back in the day, passed away, and he was 106 years old died. Yeah, so I know him from Saboteur, and I know him. He was on a Star Trek: The Next Generation episode.
Which one?
He was on I can't remember the name right now. I'm sure it's going to come to me. So it's the one where he tries to get Picard to come with him to look for this DNA evidence that he has that there's this one parent species for all of the aliens in space.
Oh, okay.
And so he's his teacher. Right? He was his old teacher.
I would have never pulled that. Good for you.
So that's a season 6 episode of Next Generation. The Chase, I think it's actually called, now that I think about it off the top of my head. But 106 years old. And we had a friend of the show, David Cairns, Him and his wife recently posted a tweet as well. So it hit them especially because they got married in 2013.
Hmm.
And, you know, David Cairns has done a lot of work for Criterion and whatnot. We had him guest on, I think it was our episode Murder, we had him guest on. But Norman Lloyd actually officiated their wedding.
Oh, my God.
So in 2013. So, you know, that kind of was special for them and, you know, a little bit sad that he passed.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so that's a little bit of sad news. 106. Yeah.
106
Holy
is
smokes.
A long time.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and that guy, I was, when you said his name, I naturally did the, I did the 21st century thing of immediately looking him up, right? And yeah, I totally recognize his face now. He's one of those guys who, like, you know, you wouldn't say he's a superstar, but it was like, oh, yeah, this guy has been in my room, my house, before on TV. It was like, I totally recognize him. I want to say he's even in some Presents episodes, too.
Is he? Okay, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if they were directed by Hitchcock or not, but I'm pretty sure, because, you know, like all those guys, it seems, you know, they're in the system, so we got you over here, we got you over there. They kept them working, it seems.
Okay.
Wow, yeah, 106.
106, that's a long life, a long, very full life. And, really? You know, so 2013 was only 8 years ago, right, which means he was 98 when he officiated
that's a long
that
life.
Wedding. Right. So, like, I know. And then, I mean, when you count back, okay, so the Star Trek The Next Generation episode was 1994, maybe 93,
okay.
Somewhere in there. So that's 28 years ago. So,
and then he's 70.
He was like 78 or 79 when he did that. So, even that's like really,
long
really
life.
Long. And he's spry in that episode. Like, he is,
yeah, right.
He looks young. I wouldn't have thought he was close to 80
wow.
in that episode, but holy Man, smokes.
Just, you don't care. He did something right.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, excellent. Okay, so we're going to jump into our discussion of To Catch a Thief. So I'm going to do my notes here for all of you wonderful listeners, a little bit of the production behind the scenes. And Philip, if I say anything interesting, you can just jump right on in. So okay. This is not, you don't have to just sit
it's
quietly.
It's not monologue time? I don't
It is not in. Monologue okay. time. So To Catch a Thief is a 1955 American romantic thriller directed by Hitchcock from a screenplay by John Michael Hayes based on the 1952 novel of the same name by David Dodge. Film stars Cary Grant as a retired cat burglar who has to save his reformed reputation by catching an imposter preying on wealthy tourists of the French Riviera. Grace Kelly stars opposite him as his romantic interest, and this is her final film with Hitchcock. Wikipedia lists the release date as August 3rd, 1955 in Los Angeles, and it has a running time of 106 minutes. Now, one interesting little fact that I didn't quite know where to put was Bridget Auber's character... which I'm bad with names. So she was the young daughter who ended up being the cat burglar at the end of the film. They kept referring to her as girl or teenager compared to Grace Kelly's supposedly more mature character. But Auber was actually 29 years old at the time of filming in 1954. And she was more than 4 years older than Grace Kelly.
That's hilarious.
I know it is. So I think that's pretty interesting.
They do that a lot. So that's a weird, I wonder how much... that comes up because I know later in North by Northwest, Cary Grant's mom is like 5 years older than him.
She's actually a year younger.
Oh, she's younger. Yeah, that's it.
Younger,
she's
yeah.
a year younger. And it's just funny how it's like, well, star power over here means you're going to believe whatever we tell you. And mm-hmm. and we'll age them up or age them down however we want. But yeah, that's not even close.
Yeah, that's funny. Now, the way that you worded that then, I am guessing I'm going to surprise you with this, in that Grace Kelly's mom in this movie is his mom in North by Northwest?
Yes. Yeah, I did. I am not surprised by that.
Okay,
yeah,
good.
I had not seen this movie for a while, and definitely not as many times as seeing North by Northwest.
Right, right, me too.
So when she came on, I'm like, that's...
Who is that? I recognize
that's
her.
That's Mrs. Thornhill. We're going to have her in a loudmouth role very soon, aren't we?
To Catch a Thief was the director's first film of five made using the VistaVision widescreen process and the last of three Hitchcock films with Grace Kelly. The film was the penultimate collaboration with Cary Grant, only North by Northwest follows. And it is also about a man with a mistaken identity who goes on a breakneck adventure to prove his innocence. Now, talking a bit about the VistaVision process, because I'm a big film kind of guy, so and I like this widescreen format, this revolution that was coming at this time to try and keep people in the theaters, you know, because TV was just around the bend there or just come out. So VistaVision is a higher resolution widescreen variant of the 35mm millimeter picture film format, which was created by engineers at Paramount Pictures in 1954. Now, Paramount did not use anamorphic processes such as CinemaScope. So now CinemaScope is what most people use, and so that's what you get with your 2.35:1, what most movies look like now. And the thing with CinemaScope is, so you would have a standard square of film, but the lens itself was distorted to like a fisheye type lens. And so that's how you would get more. And so then when the film is projected, you have to have like the reverse of it to project it so that it stretches the film into a widescreen format.
So wait, let me pause for a second. I'm taking notes and this will be on the test. so the film is bigger, your camera lens is warped one way. And then when you have to project it, you have to have the reverse type of lens or a special lens to then be able to like translate what was shot.
Yep.
Properly. Wow.
So that's how the CinemaScope process with anamorphic lenses work. Now you'll notice this if you've ever watched a Wes Anderson film.
Mm-hmm.
He's got his very centered shots. You'll notice that straight lines aren't quite straight; they're a little bit curved.
Right.
Right. Going from the center outwards, to kind of smile outwards. So that's how you can tell if it's been recorded with anamorphic lenses.
Interesting.
So Paramount did not use this process. So they refined the quality of its flat widescreen system by orienting the 35 millimeter negative horizontally in the camera gate to shoot on a larger area, which yielded a finer grain projection print. So this went through the projector sideways in order to get the image. As a finer grain film stock appeared on the market, VistaVision became obsolete, and Paramount dropped the format after only 7 years, although for another 40 years the format was used by some European and Japanese producers for feature films, and by American films such as the first three Star Wars films for a higher resolution special effects sequences. So not all the film, but in some sequences. Yeah. In many ways, VistaVision was a testing ground for cinematography ideas that evolved into 70mm, IMAX, and Omnimax film formats of the 70s. Both IMAX and Omnimax are oriented sideways, just like VistaVision.
Huh.
So I always
I didn't know about the sideways thing.
Mm-hmm. So if I can remember, I think it's the next five. So I think it's this one. Trouble with Harry, Vertigo, North by Northwest, and The Birds are his five.
The Man
five.
Who Knew Too Much? Is The Man Who Knew
I
Too
don't,
Much in
there? Maybe, so it might not be The Trouble with Harry. I'm not sure about that one. Maybe, I haven't seen The Man Too Much too long, in a long time.
Okay.
But I'm pretty sure The Birds is, I'm pretty sure North by Northwest is, and I'm pretty sure...
Vertigo definitely.
Vertigo is for sure, and this is for sure. So,
wow, okay.
Yeah, so we'll have to go through that and figure out which ones are the five. I should have
It's
had
crazy
that.
It's crazy to think about how those things, I don't know, just you take so much for granted just being an audience member, how much, you know, just like, just put the people there and they're going to speak and you're going to point the thing at them. But like all this other stuff can go into it. I'll often hear about it. I'll be interested in it. And then when I watch a movie, I totally forget about it. But all that thought process has to go into it to think, well, what's the impact?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you do something enormous. So... this will be total fanboy thing, but I think in your guys' episode on Dial M for Murder, you were talking about him using 3D, right? And it has kind of a weird effect when it's just like a chamber mystery.
Mm-hmm,
you know, it's like, I don't know. They say, is the juice really worth the squeeze on this? I don't know if we're getting an effect. And it might even be detrimental in some cases, right? It's interesting just to think like somebody had to think all that thing through to be like, okay, we're going to shoot in the French Riviera. So that'd be perfect for this, you know?
Right.
And we're going to apparently do five other movies like that. So get used to it.
Yeah, it was a competition. It's, you know, it's like all these different types of formats out there, you know, there's tons and tons of different types of audio, like, you know, Sony's dynamic digital compression, Dolby Digital, DTS, like all these weird things. So there was also a format wars with videos, and all these different companies would develop their own video type of recording software, type of film.
It makes sense. I would almost argue it makes sense that that's happening. And that, you know, there is competition for it. That's all fine. It's just kind of funny to me how few, like in the end product, is just like, and it's a movie, you know, like it's not just that. But to most people, it's like, well, it's on a screen and it's got sound and people, you know, it kind of all gets washed away because the impact of what you see is going to ultimately win out. A beautiful, crappy movie is still like crappy movie.
Excellent. So crucial to the film's success in shooting on location was the presence of unit production manager C.O. Doc Erickson. He had developed a reputation for his work on prior Paramount films that had relied on great amounts of location photography, such as Shane and Secret of the Incas. Erickson thoroughly researched the logistics of shooting in the south of France and communicated with Bill Mull, the production manager on Little Boy Lost. The costumes were designed by Edith Head, including Kelly's memorable gold lamé gown for the film's costume ball, and the car driven by Grace Kelly was a metallic blue 1953 Sunbeam Alpine MK1.
That's an awesome car.
Yeah, it is.
I'm not a car guy, but like that thing looks like... It looks... The highest compliment I can give something. It looks like something from Batman the Animated Series.
Okay.
You know, like it's just that is a styling car that I could not pick out what it was, but I'm like, that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Classy.
Now, To Catch a Thief is the only Hitchcock film released by Paramount that is still owned and controlled by the company. The others were sold to Hitchcock in the early 1960s and are currently distributed by Universal Studios.
Hmm.
Now, as for the stars of the film, most of them we've covered already. So Cary Grant, we spoke of him when we covered Suspicion. And as we said, we got one more with him, North by Northwest. Grace Kelly, we spoke of her when we covered Dial M for Murder. This is her last appearance. John Williams, we spoke of him when we covered Dial M for Murder. This is his final film appearance. But again, many, many television performances to come in Hitchcock Presents. Which again, listeners, we will be covering very shortly. So the plan for the next couple episodes is we're going to be doing a commentary next month for our summer commentary. And the plan is to do North by Northwest. Nice. And then The Trouble with Harry is coverage. And immediately following that, we're going to get into our Alfred Hitchcock Presents episodes in order. Nice. Now, last is Jesse Royce Landis, and Jesse Royce Landis was born Jesse Medbury in Chicago, Illinois, to Paul, an orchestra musician, and Ella Medbury. As per Ancestry.com, Royce does not appear to have been her middle name by birth, but her middle initial is cited as either J or T. Her acting surname Landis derives from her first husband, although she was married twice more. A scholarship that Landis received when she was 14 enabled her to attend the Hinshaw Dramatic School, which led her to acting 2 years later with the Evanston Stock Company. Now, she's going to appear one more time, as we said, as Clara Thornhill in North by Northwest, and then she is also in an Alfred Hitchcock Presents episode called Mother, May I Go Out to Swim?
Hmm.
Philip,
yes.
Did you catch the Hitchcock cameo in this movie?
Who could not catch the Hitchcock cameo? I gotta say, not the deftest of cameos.
It's right there.
It's right there. And it's an odd little moment. Like, he gets on the bus. Cary Grant gets on the bus. Looks at the woman with the bird in a cage. And it's, like, given a bit of a moment. And then he looks at Hitchcock next to him. And I'm like, was there, like, a 1950s joke about sitting next to a woman on a... like, be careful about sitting between an old man and a birdcage. I don't know. It was just a weird little thing, and then it lands with her like, oh yeah, and there he is. Like how
the framing of it is weird too, because he's right at the right edge of the screen.
Yeah.
So
I wonder. So there's a couple little like odd framing things I noticed in this movie, and maybe it's just because you gave that good summary of VistaVision and you know how this is like the first thing. I wonder how much of this was almost. I was like, it's going to be reductive, but I'm going to say like a training on it. I say that partly because, like you say, it's an odd choice to like whip over there when like you could have, the cameo would have been great if it was just like, there he is and he sits down, never acknowledge, you know, Cary Grant never acknowledges him or something, but it's just weird to pan over. There's a couple other things that was like, there's a couple things that I honestly think are like, that's a prototype for future Vertigo. Like we have rooftop chases and there's literally somebody hanging and you mentioned the costumes, there's because Edith Head does it for Vertigo too, but there's a shot of Grace Kelly with a long wispy scarf that will also happen in Vertigo with Kim Novak's costume, and I was like, hey, they're like trying out all their stuff for their future movies. But I wonder how much of that impacted, like, I don't know, knowledge of the technology versus what they're going to do. It doesn't seem like a Hitchcock thing to go in not knowing what he's going to get, but I don't know. It was a weird, yes, there's a long answer to say, Oh yeah, I got the cameo.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's a very interesting cameo. At this point, he's like, I'm just going to be in the cameo right away so that people stop looking for me and they pay attention to the movie.
Yep.
So, which is kind of funny.
I forget when that transition happened. It's been a while, like for your run, it's been a while back, right? Where he realized that people were paying less attention to the movie and looking for him. So he's looking like, I'm just going to put it, front load it. There I am. Great.
I think I Confess was probably the first time, because he just got it right out of the way in that opening shot when he just walks by in Quebec there. So I think that's probably the first one where he's just like, okay, let's just start getting it out of the way.
Yeah.
So
it's a funny problem.
Yeah. So this to me is one of the reasons why I really love Hitchcock, this film.
Okay.
You know, coming back to it for a first time in a long time, I remembered almost nothing about it. And in fact, when we get to the climax, I remembered the climax incorrectly, completely incorrectly. So this was very fresh to me. This was basically a first watch for me because I remembered virtually nothing about this film. Hmm. But I love this type of film that Hitchcock does where he selects a location and like just showcases the spot. You know, I like movies like this of the 50s and 60s where they did this. They're like
travelogue, right? The
travelogue.
Where you get to see this.
Yeah. And it's really great to see all this stuff in France. Like I've been to Cannes, right? So like these streets that they're walking on and whatnot, I'm like, that looks very familiar to what I've seen. I was in Cannes, I guess it was in 2008, I think it was. I think it was for our honeymoon. Maybe it was before our honeymoon. But we went to Cannes and while in Cannes, I'm walking around, the Cannes Film Festival is going on. I didn't see any famous people, but the Cannes Film Festival was going on at the time. And to put it in a specific date, I actually watched Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull in a theater in Cannes.
Oh, wow.
While I was there. So that's the
best place to experience that movie, I'm sure.
Yes.
But I mean, that's still great. You always remember, right?
Yeah, it had French subtitles.
Okay.
So it was kind of interesting, interesting to see. But It's neat to see these things where they just showcase what you're looking at, and they showcase the area, the country, the city, whatever it is that they're in. You know, like other movies that do this, you know, are like The Third Man, right, where they showcase Vienna, right? You know, post-war Vienna. Like, I love that kind of film.
I was thinking it was kind of a bit of a lost art, I think. Ironic, I'm saying this now in 2021, where it's like, it was back in the time when people didn't travel so much. Mm-hmm. But back then it was, you know, it seems like considerably harder. But the modern equivalent I can think of are the Richard Linklater Before movies, which are like literally about them walking around Paris. And it's less huge vistas, but it is a bit of a, we're going to show you this place. We went to this place and we're going to show you this place. And I mean, there's character stuff happening and story and stuff, but yeah, it's an interesting way of going about a movie where it's like location first, right? It's like, this will be beautiful no matter what, so we'll be fine. We'll put Grace Kelly in it, then our work is halfway done.
Now, another interesting thing about this movie that kind of stands out as being different in Hitchcock's filmography is that it's not about murder.
That's true.
You know, most of his films are about murder or death. Like, even when we get later on into The Birds, right? Like, the birds are killing.
Yeah.
Right? People are dying.
They're
the murderers. This is about robbery, right? Which is just another type of crime. And I think it makes it a really interesting aspect for him to tell a story. And I think this makes this film stand out a little bit more.
Yeah, I didn't think about that. It is, it's about a soiled reputation of a man who is recovering from his old soiled reputation, right? There's a robbery going on and he wants to stop it. So I'm full of like tangential references, but while I was watching this, I was reminded, there is this comic book series. I think it's a web comic, but they have trades, called Bandette. And, Bandette is this, The simplest way to say it is, if the actual thief in To Catch a Thief put on a mask and a cape, it would be her. She's like this sort of sprightly, fun-loving French woman who just likes to steal stuff. And part of it, I think even in their notes, they said it's sort of inspired by the idea of To Catch a Thief, where it's just like fun robbery happening over a beautiful set piece. You know? That's what we're after. It's... It is unique. You're right that there is no... The only murder that happens is of the guy with the wooden leg.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't the point. That's just kind of like up the ante, right? Yeah. Yeah,
shrapnel.
Unintended consequences.
Yes. Yeah, I like this a lot for that aspect. But it's really interesting, this character that Cary Grant plays, which is John Robbie.
The robber named Robbie. You're like, okay.
Maybe this is where they got Robbie the Robot from.
Yeah. Robbie the Robin Robot.
But the whole backstory of him, like, I'm just sitting there thinking, I would like a Netflix limited run series that's like John Robbie and the Maquis, right? Like fighting in France to like clear his name.
How they all got there. It seems like that whole kitchen is made up of that, right? So like, yeah, the time when they were like thieves and spies but on the right side of history.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. That's the,
Using their criminal tricks to outthwart the Nazis.
Yeah, like, that would actually, like, that's pretty good.
I'm totally down for that.
To catch a thief, something like that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
No, you're right. It is a interesting backstory. It's also like, this is a weird thing to say, but it's almost a little strange. So I think I'm a little less positive on the movie than you are. It's a little strange to make sure, to me, to make sure that we like him. You know what I mean? Like, it's different. If they had not told us he's like a war hero who fought the Nazis and the French resistance or whatever, then he's just a thief who has given it up.
Mm-hmm.
But that little extra thing means you're like, oh, okay, well, you know, now I can trust you, I guess. But it almost feels a little, and maybe it's part of the time too. Like, you know, obviously in the 50s, you would have run into people who really did that sort of thing in World War II more often. But watching it now, I'm a little like, okay. You know, it's like, it's shorthand for, he's a good guy. Go, folks, we can trust him.
Yeah, because he fought the Nazis.
Yeah, he fought the Nazis and he won. And I don't know why those guys don't like him. Isn't that too bad that our hero, you know, I don't know. It felt a little shorthandy to me. But I understand why they did it, because you have to, it's like, he's the hero. You'd have to do something. You have to have some reason to like him. Something.
So the other question on that then, though, is, I mean, this is Cary Grant. And can you not like Cary Grant?
That would have been the number of reasons. Yeah. And what's funny, I'm glad you say that, because I think maybe that's part of why I see that as almost a strain. Because in other movies, in other Hitchcock movies, I think he wisely relies on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was like, taken as it is, Jimmy Stewart's character in Rear Window is not someone that you should really empathize with. He's kind of a jerk and he's sullen and he's stupid enough to like reject Grace Kelly. So it's like, you got three strikes. I don't know what to do for you, man. Except you're Jimmy Stewart. You know, like, but I know that he saved the building and loan. Like, that guy, it carries a lot of weight. And so it is, I feel like it's a little weird to like, yeah, you have arguably the most charismatic movie star ever. It's like, you don't have to do a whole lot. You just like, let him, I'm on board. I don't know. It just, yeah, maybe that's kind of why I'm getting that. Cause usually that shorthand is present even in Hitchcock movies or used against us or something. But here it's like, oh, but we're really going to explain it. And then you could have been like, well, then you could have gotten anybody. Like, why did you put Cary Grant in this? It's like his powers are being underused.
Yes. Because, like, Cary Grant is Cary Grant, right? I mean, like, even in Notorious, I mean, like, when we covered Notorious, I get confused with my title. Notorious is the one with Ingrid Bergman, right?
Yes.
Good. Even in Notorious, like, at the end of that episode, I think that's the only time when I haven't liked Cary Grant is in that episode. And at the end of the episode, we're like, this is not a happy ending to this movie. Like, there's still bad things going on. And at the end of Notorious, I'm like, I still think he was trying to kill her, right? Uh-huh. So like, we had some issues with that one there. But even here, like, this guy is basically the same character that he plays in North by Northwest. Mm-hmm. He's just less confused right now, right?
Yeah, he's less confused.
So, I mean, like, that's just Cary Grant. He's very charming. I mean, like, even in, you know, Charade, if you've seen Charade, mm-hmm. like, he this era of Cary Grant is, like, he's one role, and that's it. And mm-hmm. When you put him there, he's just going to play that guy.
It's the thing that they kind of perfected, in my mind, with the first, well, not the first, but the first George Clooney Ocean's 11 movie, mm-hmm. where what they figured out was, like, we got our tight script as far as, like, the, you know, the heist and everything like that. We also have George Clooney and Brad Pitt, and they're going to be super charming all the time. Okay, mm-hmm. go. You know, like mm-hmm. there is something to as it almost feels like, I don't know, like I'm worshiping kings or something like that. But there is something to star power that is like it carries a lot of weight. You know, like mm-hmm. I remember a story of my own. I was writing some story, and it was about a band, and they were trying to do this, trying to do that, and I kept getting these notes. That of trying to make the heroes likable or how to make them relatable and stuff like that. And they kept mentioning the movie School of Rock.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end, I was finally like thinking to myself, it's like, these notes are fine. I get it. But let's also not forget that School of Rock just has Jack Black. It's like, there's something to, like, he's kind of a jerk. We kind of like him for it. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. that's kind of it. And the same thing with the Cary Grant character at this point, like you said, he's sort of perfected it and he's going to be, sort of sassy, but like unflappable. And it's fun to see him get into tight situations and then get out of it. And I'm like, that's what we get with Cary. Like, that's why we're here. That's what we paid our ticket for, was to see mm-hmm, him do mm-hmm. that. And yeah, it's sometimes it works better than others. I think North by Northwest uses that a little better
mm-hmm.
to that. Getting ahead of your list, but yeah, in this case, I thought it was a little like almost underused or underserved Cary Grant. I don't know. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It just had it kind of just that part left me a little cold when usually I'm in for Cary Grant.
Okay. The plot of this. So let's talk about the part where I was saying earlier where I misremembered the climax of this film.
Right.
So I loved this movie this time around. I remembered not liking it very much the first time I saw it. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was very surprised with how much I liked it this time, but I need to watch it again because my remembrance of this film was that Grace Kelly was the thief. And I don't know why I thought that. So watching this movie, I'm watching everything she's doing through this false filter of me thinking that she's the thief.
Yeah.
So when it turned out to not be her at the end, I was completely surprised.
Huh. This is my second, I think, time with it also. And I think I did remember from the first time that Grace Kelly was not the thief. But I can see how you maybe got that conclusion, even just given the text. Mm-hmm. Because there's like a couple parts, so almost a la what she does in Rear Window, where she's sort of like, lack of a better term, flirting with danger. You know, she mm-hmm. she keeps throwing out these ideas of like, you know, how you're going to get in and going to do that and going to do this and going to do that. And I swear we've seen other movies, maybe not with Grace Kelly, maybe with, where, you know, it's not just a fan fixation. It's like, oh, I really am the thief. So I picked that up this time. I kind of wish that it had played more with that. I think they needed, for me, I would have liked, I guess the word's more red herrings. I would have liked more, like, it could be them. It could be them. It could be, you know, like, it could be anybody. We don't know. And it kind of isn't there. For me, I felt like its hand was a little tipped, just that, I forget the young woman's name, the character, but.
Yeah, me too.
Proto Bandette is just like, she's kind of so full of life and up for the challenge that I was like, oh, I think it's her. Just by. It's not going to be John Williams. It's not going to be Grace Kelly's mom. Could maybe be Grace Kelly, but, you know, it just, we also have to grapple with the sort of 50s shocking revelation of like, the thief was a woman, you know, like part of it, I think that was also for the time, a big shocker, you know?
Right.
But to your point, I think that there's some of that baked in there that you're almost supposed to suspect Grace Kelly is up to something.
Okay. Well, then I don't feel so bad.
Maybe you carried that. Maybe whatever residual Grace Kelly-ness came through with that, and you took that with you to be like, oh, I think she's the thief. And then, mm-hmm. so yeah, maybe that could be explored in the prequel. The prequel series can get into her dabbling with also getting into thievery.
I think that the prequel series would have her father involved, right?
Oh,
in
yeah.
some sort of situation with the Maquis group. And then off to the side, we just see little Grace Kelly, like some young blonde girl.
Yep.
Right? So,
yeah.
And then their paths had crossed once before.
Yep. The 12 episodes right there. We're set.
Let's write this. Let's call Netflix. You got some ins, right? You said you're in Los Angeles.
Yep. Every house has a red phone plugged into Netflix.
Excellent. So I don't quite feel so bad then, because yeah, I definitely picked up on that. So maybe that was
that's
the thing.
Yeah. I think that I would think that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. So, you know, I don't have much to say about him, but I mean, John Williams is always a joy to see on screen.
Yeah.
You know, he's just his tone and his personality. He's just an absolute joy. And I'm looking forward to some viewer response on some of the Hitchcock Presents episodes. I hope that all you guys listen along, because there's some really great episodes in it in Hitchcock Presents coming up. And he's just a joy to watch. You know, we just had him recently on Dial M for Murder.
Yeah. He seems like... I haven't put much study into this, but he seems like kind of a carryover of older style, like England film world Hitchcock into these American movies. You know, like he fits into a lot of that, because so much of, you know, Hitchcock's career spanning a million years, it's dealing with so many different topics of those eras. And even just like the social norms of it are weird. And so to have like a sort of a stiff upper lip by the book Englishman in it feels in line with those earlier movies. And in some way it's kind of funny that like part of the climax, the pre-climax of this movie, To Catch a Thief, is sort of down to, can the old man keep dancing? You know, like that's sort of what it's hanging on to. And there's almost this like, there's a certain level of propriety that Hitchcock either has in his movies or incorporates in the stories or challenges. And I think that somebody like John Williams embodies that kind of thing, where it's just like, of course I have this trim little mustache and this hat. And like, he fits right into like, I'm trying to think of like maybe the first, Man Who Knew Too Much, or what's the one with the film canisters that blow up.
Oh,
Sabotage. I think it's Sabotage. Yeah. I don't know. It just strikes me as that sort of thing. And I wonder, like, you know, we don't get too many of him in these movies beyond this point.
He would have been a great choice for Alfred on a Batman TV show.
Yes, he is a fantastic. Yes, he is. That is a good Alfred. Yeah, the guy who's like always right there. Also, I don't know if you know the answer to this. It's just a curious thing. So I am not, nor may I ever be, a wealthy socialite traveling the French Riviera with tons of diamonds. But if I were, would I take the insurance guy with me? Like, is that what's happening? The insurance guy is just there, or is he investigating claims? Why is John Williams there? That's what I can't.
So
the State Farm doesn't do that.
Yeah, so what I got from it is that, so he lives in France and he works for this company, or else he's been sent to France to investigate because of all these burglaries that are going on. And so he's investigating them, and he's visiting clients that are in the area that have wealthy policies that are going on with them right now. So that's why he's meeting with them for dinner. Like, I don't get the impression that he just has dinner with his clients all the time.
I guess
but it's
not.
Probably to give him a heads up, because he's there trying to convince her to put her stuff in a safe.
That's
right?
True.
So that it doesn't get stolen. I do think, though, like, so he's involved with Cary Grant, and I find that a little bit of a convenient plot point that they're going to give him that information.
Yeah.
So, you know, and where he's like, I even told the police that I did this and whatnot. So, like, that's a little bit convenient for the plot of the film, and I'm guessing that's probably something that came directly from the book. But I get over it, because it's like, I don't know how else they could have
No.
Done it. You know, how else would they get involved with each other to solve the crime?
No. I mean, there might have been some other way, but yeah, it's probably just a convenience thing to be like, okay, somebody has to trust this dude. So let's just get them there and then we can move on. So we have other things to do.
Yeah.
I get it. But yeah, thank you for that. I just couldn't. He was just around so much. And this, after an hour, I was like, I've never talked to my insurance man this much in my life. Like these guys are like best friends. What is the relationship here? So I just, I got flummoxed around, but you're right. He's chasing after the, that's it.
Cause there's a lot of crimes going on. A lot of jewels being stolen.
A lot of jewels.
And then like watching, like I had this whole backstory in my head for Grace Kelly. I'm like, okay, so the reason why she's stealing all this stuff is because she loves this stuff and her mom doesn't love it. Like, her mom doesn't care about jewelry at all. And so I thought it was going to be like this is something that her dad gave her before he died, like with some of the early money that they had as a family and whatnot. So, but I guess the dad died before they had money. So maybe, I don't know. I just was coming up with this idea.
No, that could have been, I wish that was in there. I think part of what left me a little cold with this movie, both times that I've watched it, is that it's a little just surface level for me. And things like that, and maybe it's just, you know, I've seen more movies since then and I'm more accustomed to those twists or what have you, but it seems like it needed like a couple extra just little mysteries to solve. The main one is, who is this cat? Who is the cat burglar if it's not John? And part of it's hilarious that, like, the cops are after this cat burglar, but only the cat burglar, John Robbie, knows to hang out on the roof, guys.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the cops never think, put a person on the roof. They're always like, get your George Washington costumes and get a good stand around there. And you're like, guys, every one of these has been through a window and the roof practically. So you gotta like put some guys up there, get some binoculars or something. And like, I guess that's why he's good at his job. But for me, it just needed like a couple of those things. And I like this angle of, if Grace Kelly turned out in our alternate version or expanded Netflix series coming soon, if she doesn't turn out to be a cat burglar, then she has some sort of like weird relationship with thrill seeking, you know, that she's this, you know, kept woman or, you know, this debutante who's never allowed to thrive. And it would have been interesting. I think it's like, it's in there just a little bit, but if it took like a couple more twists to tighten that up, it would have been really interesting to see her like, sort of like what they do in Rear Window, where she, you know, you can't do that. You're from Fashion Row. And she's like, I can too. I'm going to scale this wall and go into the murderer's house. And like, it needed, for me, I think like it was missing those couple little things. And I don't know if also, I'm rambling here, but I don't know if I'm associating this unfairly to the movie, because I keep comparing it to things like North by Northwest and to Rear Window, because A, there's proximity and they're obviously directed by the same guy, but they have the same stars. And
right.
It's hard for me not to say like, boy, you nailed this a movie ago and you're going to nail this, you know, like a couple movies down the road. And it's just like, it's just like, I can't tell if I'm just not giving it the benefit of the doubt, cause it's not the greatest hits, you know?
That makes sense.
It might just be me, but that's my thing.
Makes sense. So Phil, is there anything that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to address?
What haven't we covered? I wrote notes, most of which are probably just snarky things. but one thing I did want to notice. So earlier, I mentioned the idea of cozy mysteries, right? This movie almost qualifies as a cozy mystery by the general rules. So we have an amateur sleuth where John Robbie, he's not a detective. He's a thief, but he's like forced into this mystery. He's got to figure out who it is. There's non-sex sex.
And lots of fireworks.
Lots of fireworks. Could have done with about five less shots of fireworks. It's hilarious because that's another thing that, like, not to spoil North by Northwest, but, you know, there's a famous symbolism, quote unquote, that happens there, but they don't keep cutting to it.
No.
You know?
It's like one and done.
Just one and done. So we got that. There's sort of low gore violence. There's not, you know, not like that. There's also a pet. So a big thing and often happens in cozy mysteries is there's a dog or a cat. And this movie, like, really leans on that cat in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And that's another one that I was also kind of like, all right, I get it. Cat burglar. This is like the invention of the phrase cat burglar or something. It's like, it's like a cat, you guys. Like, yeah, we got it. So it almost qualifies by those standards. It's you know, everything
kind of works
out.
To catch a thief is a play as well, because there's the saying, it takes a thief to catch a thief.
Yeah, there you go. Yes.
And the two women are trying to catch the thief themselves.
There you go. See, it's
for the love interest.
It's all there. And maybe, I forget who wrote the original book, but maybe he stumbled on that. Mm-hmm. I'm just glancing at my notes here. I did have that thing about the fireworks. That was really kind of hilarious. Mm-hmm.
David Dodge wrote the book. David Dodge.
Thank you, David Dodge. Yeah. Oh, there was one thing that I noticed that if I can't discuss here, then where could I? So at the party, the mm-hmm. final party, Grace Kelly and who we think is Cary Grant is actually John Williams are dancing. The party dwindles away. It's, you know, midnight or whatever. And then they decide we're going to go inside. Mm-hmm. They walk into that like palace. The background inside the palace looks like it's daytime. And when I say that, I mean like the windows. It looks like there's windows in there. And I can't tell if those are like diegetic paintings of a daytime scene or like a mistake that, oh, those are supposed to be nighttime panels, but we messed up. I can't tell. So the next time you watch it, hopefully I don't ruin everything. The next time you watch it, pay attention to that, because it's weird. It's like there's like two or three arches and they have trees in them. And if it was daytime, I never would have noticed it. But just something about it this time, I was like, it's like that's day, but that's night. It's all in the same. What's going on here?
I didn't notice that.
Yeah. It just for a second, I'm like, I can't tell if. Is this house so well off that they can afford? It was like, we want a giant vista of the daytime version of our outside inside our house. I kind of doubt that, but I don't know. There was one more. I feel like I had one more thing. Oh, I was going to mention the slap that happens. So he clocks this girl. And it's a weird scene.
At the funeral.
At the funeral, yeah. That funeral scene is kind of, I feel like, inadvertently hilarious because you have, it's a good shot of, you know, all these sort of sad faces and Cary Grant staring at her, right? And then she chews him out and he slaps her. So we could say a lot about that, but there's books that we could deal with that. And then he goes to leave and like nobody lets him. It's almost like they're going to fight him, but then they do. And then the part that makes me laugh the hardest is then the priest is like, right back to Latin. And like, he didn't even say anything about it. Just like, no, man, I bothered it. No, slap. Oh my God, a little scene. And then that happens and he walks away and then it just, no, man, I bothered it. And it's like, oh, he doesn't. Boy, he's really taking care of his parishioners here, this guy. It's just like, I just got to get this guy buried and out of here. I got five more of these babies. No, that's I, funny. Yeah, I, those are my cheap shots. I'm glad I could talk about it. I'm glad you had me on. I really like the Hitchcock movies. I'm glad I found your show. I'm very grateful to be part of this and to pick up the slack for Tom and Chris when they're not here.
Slackers. Bunch of slackers.
Slackers with their busy lives and full adventures.
Yeah, it was so crazy trying to
plan this month. It's hard, a tough man. One.
Usually around this time in summer is when we have difficulties. So if you go back through our catalog, like this is about the time when Tom did his interview about the dogs.
Oh, okay.
A couple years ago, right? So like we usually have at this point, you know, this is usually when we have a tough time and it happens kind of every year. So
that makes sense.
But we are, thanks so much for joining us. We're grateful to have you on here, Philip. Why don't you tell listeners where they can find you online? Please. And is there a place where they can find some information on your upcoming book?
Yes, they can. They can go to philipmottas.com. That's PHILLIPMOTTAZ. It looks like Motaz. philipmottas.com. They can sign up for a newsletter there. I promise you would only be offered free things and possibly and no spam, but you get to hear about upcoming things. I'm on Twitter. Same handle, philipmottas. And please look for my book, The Murderous Haircut of the Mayor of Bel-Air. It'll be released in September of 2021.
Excellent. Right on. Well, at this time, we'd like to thank the members of the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show. Our show is available in their feed as well as our own independent feed. Thank you so much to our friends Annie and Catherine. Be sure to check out their show, Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents Podcast. Thank you so much to our friend Jason Cullimore for his wonderful, wonderful theme music. You can find Chris on Twitter at @hire_boy. Tom is on Twitter at TomCaldwell3000. And I'm available on Twitter at Brandon Metella. And right now, I've only got two other podcasts going on. I got Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek, and I have Franchise Fatigue, which covers movies, remakes, and sequels. And we have just jumped into our coverage of the King Kong franchise.
Oh,
over there.
Man.
So that's a lot of fun.
It's going to take your, there's your summer.
Yeah, it's going to take a while. We've recorded a couple already. There's a couple in there that I haven't seen yet. I haven't seen King Kong Escapes, and I haven't seen the 1976 King Kong or its sequel, King Kong Lives. So there's three of them that I haven't seen yet. Those will be first time watches for me. Nice. So excellent. So until next time, when we hit our summer commentary of North by Northwest, good evening.
Good evening.